I'd share with you a line of a song. It was written just a few years back by a popular band. The title goes something like this, or the lyric goes something like this. My best friend gave me the best advice. He said, each day's a gift and not a given right. Leave no stone unturned, leave your fears behind, and try to take the path less traveled by. That first step you take is the longest stride. If today was your last day and tomorrow was too late, could you say goodbye to yesterday? It's a song made popular by the band Three Doors Down. And the song tells the story of an individual basically saying, if today was your last day, would you be able to handle the future, whatever it might be? Would you, if you knew that today was your last day, would you be able to go back and forgive those that had wronged you? Would you be able to go back and take care of the things that you had left undone? It's an interesting story from the standpoint of a modern song, but in certain respects, there's a spiritual message, I think, for us as we'll get into this afternoon. Turn me over to 2 Kings chapter 20. We know that this physical life will end at some point in time. We have no idea when it's going to be. We have no guarantee. And as that song's lyrics went through, you come to understand, if today was the last day, what would you do? What would you take with you? What were the memories? What would you not allow to have left or have left undone, an end result of where it stands right now? 2 Kings chapter 20. Here we find a story of Hezekiah. King Hezekiah was very ill. King Hezekiah was sick. He was dying, but he cried out to God. Notice here in 2 Kings chapter 20, beginning in verse 1, he said, in those days, Hezekiah was sick and near death, and Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amoz, went to him and said to him, thus says the Lord, set your house in order, for you shall die and not live. Today is your last day. Tomorrow is going to be too late. Set your house in order. Verse 2, then he turned his face toward the wall and prayed to the Lord, saying, remember now, O Lord, I pray, how I have walked before you in truth and with a loyal heart and have done what was good in your sight. And Hezekiah wept bitterly. It happened before Isaiah had gone out into the middle court that the word of the Lord came to him, saying, return and tell Hezekiah, the leader of my people, thus says the Lord, the God of David your father, I have heard your prayer. I have seen your tears. Surely I will heal you. On the third day you shall go up to the house of the Lord, and I will add to your days 15 years. Now, it's interesting. You know, we talk about not knowing how much time we have. Here, God, through, again, an intermediary, is telling Hezekiah, tell you what, I'm going to give you date specific. I'm giving you 15 years. I'll add to your days 15 years. I will deliver you and this city from the hand of the king of Assyria, and I will defend this city for my own sake and for the sake of my servant David. Hezekiah is dying. He's crying out to God to see what he can do, and ultimately we see that his life was extended 15 years. God had given him an additional 15 years. When he started with that whole statement that we read there, it was get your house in order because today is your last day. Not literally, but you understand what I'm saying. You don't have any time. You're going to die. The question for us is, what would Hezekiah do with that time that he was given? In other words, he was given another 15 years. What would he do with it? Would he be bitter? Would he be angry that it was only 15 years? Would he be thankful for the extra time? And as I said, what would he do with it? What would he do with it? We find the answer over in Isaiah chapter 38. Let's go over there for a moment. Isaiah chapter 38. Let's pick up the answer to this from Isaiah's own words. Isaiah chapter 38. Notice beginning here in verse 9. He says, this is the writing of Hezekiah, king of Judah, when he had been sick and had recovered from his sickness. So this is a time after, obviously, God had told him, I'm going to extend your life 15 years. Verse 10, I said in the prime of my life, I shall go to the gates of Sheol. I am deprived of the remainder of my years. He had a realization that his life was going to end after that 15 years. And the question is, okay, now what am I going to do with it? Verse 11, I said, I shall not see Yah, the Lord, in the land of the living. I shall observe man no more among the inhabitants of the world. I can't go to the temple and see Joe every Sabbath. This is the realization of the fact that I won't have these relationships with people any longer. Verse 12, my lifespan is gone, taken from me like a shepherd's tent, temporary. I have cut off my life like a weaver. He cuts me off from the loom. From day until night, you make an end of me. I have considered until morning like a lion, so he breaks all my bones. From day until night, you make an end of me, like a crane or a swallow, so I chattered. I mourned like a dove, my eyes frail from looking upward. O Lord, I am oppressed. Undertake for me. His supplication to God to intervene. Notice verse 15. What shall I say? He has both spoken to me, and he himself has done it. I shall walk carefully all my years in the bitterness of my soul. In other words, I understand that I've only been given these 15 years, but he's making a determination to change his ways. Verse 16, O Lord, by these things men live, and in all these things is the life of my spirit, so you will restore me and make me live. Indeed, it was for my own peace that I had great bitterness, but you have lovingly delivered my soul from the pit of corruption, for you have cast all of my sins behind your back. Hezekiah had to go through what he did in order to come to peace. He was told, today is your last day. Get your affairs in order. He beseeched God, and God said, I'm going to give you 15 more years. I'd like to ask the question this afternoon. If today was your last day, how would you live it? If today was your last day, how would you live it? As the lyrics of that song go, if tomorrow is too late, what would you be willing to do? I know it's a strange question, but when we look at what happened to Hezekiah, it should give us a pause and ask, what would we be willing to do? What would we be prepared to do if we were in his shoes? Would we be willing to live like today was our last day? Turn me over to Psalm chapter 90. Psalm chapter 90. Beginning in verse 1, Psalm chapter 90 and verse 1, it says, Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. We understand that. Nobody in this room denies that God is our God. We go through an understanding there of what is being spoken as Moses speaks this prayer, but I want to drop down to verse number 10. He says, the days of our lives are 70 years, and if by reason of strength they are 80 years, yet their boast is only labor and sorrow, for it is soon cut off and we fly away. Who knows the power of your anger? For as the fear of you, so is your wrath. So teach us to number our days, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Numbering our days. Hezekiah literally had the ability to number his days. When God intervened and says, I'll give you 15 years. So he could simply go 365 times 15 and know how much time he had. He had a calendar out, he could stroke it through an X every day. We don't necessarily have that same ability. We can look at this particular scripture and go, okay, 70 are at the best 80, but we don't know. The question is not the time, the question is, what are we going to do with it? When we look at this concept of numbering our days, we begin to understand the shortness of this physical existence. I find that more and more when I speak with my sister, it's not about the situation of what's going on in her life and what's going on in my life. It's more about our parents. What are we going to do when dad dies? What are we going to do when mom dies? Now, these are conversations that decades ago my sister and I never had. The conversations we had years ago was who was going to be able to have the car on Saturday night, myself or my sister. But now we begin to understand the shortness of life. We begin to realize what is going on here. I want you to take a look here at 1 Samuel chapter 20 and verse 3. 1 Samuel chapter 20 and verse 3. I think there's times when we have to take pause. When we think about the sermonette and getting in that position, having the will to be in the position to win, in order to train for something like that, you know, whether it was what Mr. Rands was speaking about or his friend who held these Oregon State records, I'm fairly certain and sure, not knowing the man, but I'm probably 99 and 44 100% sure he didn't start training 3 days before a meet. He trained weeks, months, maybe even years in advance. That's what an athlete does. Notice 1 Samuel chapter 20 and verse 3. Again, David here speaking as David is talking with Jonathan. And notice verse 3 says, "Then David took an oath again and said, 'Your father,'" speaking of Saul, "'certainly knows that I have found favor in your eyes.' And he said, 'Do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. But truly, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is but a step between me and death.'" Now, in David's word, or in what we just read back in Psalm chapter 90, we see the statement that is made to teach us to number our days. We're told that at 70 or 80 are at the best 80, 70 or 80 years. But here David makes an interesting statement. He says, "There is but a step between me and death." In other words, you're seeing a finality there. It's a profound statement. David's knowledge that Saul was after his very life. Let's take another look at another couple of scriptures in this regard. Psalm chapter 39. Psalm chapter 39. I hope I'm not being too morbid this afternoon, but I want to lay the foundation here before we get into what I call the good stuff about how we need to take the time that we have given. But before we get there, we need to think about this a little bit. We have no guarantees. I've often said that, you know, when my wife and I will pray and when we offer up a blessing at the end of the day for our dinner, one of the first things I'll thank God is for the protection through the day. We take things for granted sometimes. We really do. It's something that we ought not do based upon the fact of the statements that are made. When you read David's statements, a stop between my life and death. Look at another statement here, Psalm chapter 39, beginning in verse 4. It says, "Lord, make me to know my end and what is the measure of my days, that I may know how frail I am. Indeed, you have made my days as handbreadths, and my age is as nothing before you. Certainly every man at his best state is but vapor." Phew. It's gone. It's gone. When you look at the words of God the Father who says 1,000 years is as a day, you look at 80 years at best and go, that's a hiccup. It's small. It's but a vapor. Our life is short. It is fleeting. Does that mean we live as hermits, as individuals just waiting every day for impending death? Well, no, of course not. Notice over in Psalm 118. Psalm 118. Let's go the right direction, Pinelli. That would be to the left and not to the right. Psalm 118. It's the problem with using an online Bible. You just click on, you don't turn the pages. Psalm 118, and notice verse 24. Psalm 118 and verse 24, he says, "This is the day the Lord has made. We will rejoice and be glad in it." As we live this life, we must understand what it all means. The importance of it, the importance of everything that we go through, the importance of living this day as if it was our last day. Notice just a couple more verses here. Ecclesiastes chapter 9. Ecclesiastes chapter 9. Again, the writing of this, we come to understand Solomon is looking at things and pontificating in certain respects as these things are read and as we read them, as they're written down. And as we go through and see something about Ecclesiastes, he always talks about man grasping at the wind, grasping at the air. Notice Ecclesiastes chapter 9. He makes a statement here, beginning in verse 5. Notice what he says. He says, Ecclesiastes 9, verse 5, "For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. And they have no more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Also their love, their hatred, and their envy have now perished. Nevermore will they have a share in anything done under the sun." The things that we deem as important are nothing at death. They just simply aren't. Verse 7. "Go, eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works. Let your garments always be white, and let your head lack no oil. Live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, which he has given you under the sun, all your days of vanity, for that is your portion in life and in the labor which you perform under the sun." He's talking about this physical life that we go through. So in one sense, he's talking about death here. There's no memory. There's nothing left. And then he transitions in verse 7 to say, go, eat, drink, and be merry, making certain and sure that your garments are white. Verse 10, "Whatever your hand finds to do it with your might, for there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you are going." Taking advantage of this physical life. Not lying there as you literally have minutes or hours before you die saying, I wish I would have done the following. It was an interesting conversation that my wife had with my mother, and we're kind of talking about retirement, and she asked my mom if retirement had gone the way she thought, and she said, well, in certain respects, yes, but she says, I thought we would travel more. So things that you realize at this particular point in life, based upon my father being 80, my mother being 76, they don't have the ability to do certain things anymore because just of the state of condition that they're in terms of the physical age. Mind is sharp, but the physical body is just not able to do certain things. So we take advantage of life. We rejoice in the day. We don't live like hermits, just, oh, woe is me, waiting for impending death. Therefore, our life must be twofold, brethren. To be cautious and careful with the life we're given, we don't do foolhardy things, obviously. But secondly, to live it to the fullest. In other words, live like today is your last day. What would you do if today was your last day? There's a story of a professor. Some of you probably know the man. He was a professor at Carnegie Mellon University. He was a married father of three. His name was Randy Pausch. His last name is spelled P-A-U-S-C-H, but it's pronounced Pausch. He was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer back, I believe, in 2007. It was a month after his diagnosis that he said goodbye to his students in a final lecture that it's now a sensation on the internet. It's deemed the final lecture. And on YouTube, it's actually been viewed over 19 million times. He wrote a book shortly before his death. It was entitled The Last Lecture. And again, it was based upon this final lecture that he gave to his students. It sold over 5 million copies in the United States alone. It was translated into 48 languages. The last lecture was, again, an ultimate thing that he went through in his mind of, what would I say in this final lecture? This is the final time he's going to talk to these students. In other words, today, in a sense, he was saying, this is my last day. So as your teacher, what am I going to say to you? What am I going to give to you that hopefully will impact you? He talked about the condition that he was in, and you know, he's sort of lighthearted about it. He was not morose. In fact, during his lecture at several times, he would get down and do push-ups to show everybody that he wasn't this frail human being that didn't have the ability to still get around and be physically active. He made the statement that you can't change the cards that you've been dealt, but you have to play the hand. And then as he went through his lecture, he talked about what would you do. He talked about childhood dreams and anything being possible, never losing that spirit. He made the statement, experience is what you get when you don't get what you want. Too often we find that, don't we? He then gives a list of principles to live by. The seven principles. They were interesting for me as I read those several years ago. And they're interesting for us because in everything that he states, I believe there is a spiritual lesson or a spiritual principle to live by. I'd like to give those seven points or those seven principles to live by and frame them under the understanding of this sermon. If today was your last day, if tomorrow was too late, what would you do? Let's look at the first principle that he gave. Principle number one. He said, when someone rides you, it is because they care about you. Now, in terms of riding, you're talking about someone who is correcting you, someone who is telling you you need to change certain things. So he uses the term riding. You know, it's a slang term of sorts that we use today when someone's correcting us. You know, why are you riding me? When someone rides you, it's because they care about you. When they stop riding, they stop caring. When they stop riding, they stop caring. You know, nobody likes to be told what to do. It goes against the very basis of basic human nature. I don't think anyone in this room necessarily likes to be told. It's something that we have to break out of. If I'm told that I have to drive in this particular lane, but I don't want to drive in this particular lane. If I'm told I have to eat this, and I don't want to necessarily eat this. But sometimes we have to be told. And again, this comes from the standpoint of God, sometimes having to correct us. It's difficult at times, but when you look at that particular point, when someone cares about you, when they're riding you, it is because they care about you. So let's turn that around for a second. At the point when God stops riding us, it means he stopped caring about us. That's not a condition that we want to find ourselves in. We don't ever want to find ourselves in that condition. Notice over in Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12. Let's pick it up here in verse 5. Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 5. And he says, and you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as to sons. Now, what is he talking about? He is quoting Proverbs chapter 3, verses 11 and 12. And he quotes it here. He says, my son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens and scourges every son whom he receives. We think of it from the standpoint of course corrections. If you remember the movie, I believe it was Apollo 13 that Tom Hanks starred in, it was the failed mission to go to the moon. If you saw that movie or you remember the story, you know anything about that story, you know that they had to make their way back to Earth. In order to enter the Earth's atmosphere, you have to come in at a certain trajectory, at a certain angle, because if you don't come in that right trajectory, you can bounce off the Earth's atmosphere, you're lost up into space. Or if you come in at the wrong angle, you can burn up upon reentry. They were without the propulsion system that they needed in order to get where they needed to be. So they basically had a backup system. Now again, I don't know how vivid the movie is or the portrayal of it. It's rather, you know, the dramatic from the standpoint of Hollywood and what they do. But as you look at that particular thing where they're trying to keep this particular point of view in the viewfinder, they're giving the thrust of the engines just a little thrust here and a little thrust there. In other words, it's these slight course corrections to keep in that window that they had where they needed to be. So it wasn't the situation we think of maybe like a car. You're on the gas all the time, as hard as you can, and off the gas. It was a quick thrust, moving it this way or moving it that way. You think of it the same way. If we're on this path to the kingdom of God, and the knowledge and understanding that path winds around, and there are times when we find ourselves off the path, God rides us by giving us a course correction to push us back on the path. You would call them a trial. That's designed, again, to get us back on the path. Now, where we get so far off the path that he has to really hit the thruster and push us hard, that's the sore or the fiery trial that sometimes we have to go through because we've gotten too far off the path. Maybe we have ignored the course correction, the slight thrust that came at one time. That's where you get into the statement, don't despise the chastening. Don't despise the thrust to get you back on the path. Because the one that then gets, as you get further into the weeds and off the trail, the course correction is going to come back. It's going to be a lot worse. It's going to be a lot harder. It's going to be more painful. So again, the statement here, don't despise that. Verse 7, if you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom a father does not chasten? I've told the story before. When I was growing up as a teenager, I was convinced that my parents laid awake at night trying to think about ways to make my life miserable. But when you become a parent, when you go further on in life and you go through some of the challenges of life, you begin to realize, no, they did that because they were trying to keep me on a path. They're trying to keep me on a path. That's the same thing God does. He rides us because he cares. We never want to get to that point where he does not care anymore. Second principle. Brick walls are there for a reason. Brick walls are there for a reason. They show us how badly we want it. I remember years ago when I came out of Ambassador College, for the first 6 years of my life, I worked as a salesman. I was selling life and health insurance to farmers in Northwest Indiana. It's a difficult process when you're cold calling somebody and their corn is burning up in the field or their soybeans are burning up in the field and you're asking them for $3,000 of their money, for insurance no less. You know, insurance agents, they're thought about a lot like used car salesmen. Nobody likes them. You understand that brick walls are there for a reason. I remember a statement, though, that my state manager said one time when he was on, we were out on calls. And we'd gone through a couple calls and they'd gone fairly easy. And then we had a couple others that weren't as easy. We didn't make any sales. And I remember a statement when we got in the car, we were driving out of the driveway. He said, John, he says, it can't always be easy. He says, if it was, everybody would be doing it. You think about it from the standpoint of the crooked path or the winding path, as Christ talks about this path that winds through it. It's not a super highway. And oftentimes we find in this path there are brick walls that are in front of us. They're there for a reason. There's going to be three types of individuals. There's going to be an individual that looks at the brick wall and says, nah, can't be done. We're out of here. There's going to be the second individual that looks at the brick wall. They may try for a period of time. They say, you know what? This isn't going to work to go over it. I'm going to find an easy way around it. But ultimately, you realize that you have to go over that wall. You can't go under it. You can't go around it. You simply have to push right through it. It goes back to the realization of the walls of Jericho coming down when God told them on that seventh day, on the last day of unleavened bread, when you go around the city seven times and the walls come down, go right up into the center of the city. Don't nip around the edges. That's the whole standpoint of a brick wall. It's there for a reason. It shows us how badly we want it. This is nothing new. Christ and the apostles told us that there would be walls. Let's go back to a couple of verses in that regard. John chapter 16. Let's take a look just at one verse here. John chapter 16 and verse 33. John 16 and verse 33. This is again the prayer that Christ is offering up, again, as I say, as we look at John chapter 14 through 17 and even into 18, you find that these are some of the final words that he's going to say from the standpoint of when he's finally led away and again is crucified. John 16 and verse 33, he says, "These things I have spoken to you that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer, I have overcome the world." He didn't say might. He didn't say maybe. When we face the brick wall, it's there for a reason. He says, you're going to have brick walls. But in a sense, he says, be cheerful about it. He says, I've shown you the way through it. Acts chapter 14 and verse 22 tells us, we don't need to turn there, Paul makes the statement, it is only through much trial, much tribulation that we will enter into the kingdom of God. I'm paraphrasing. Walls must be there to show us how badly we want it, and we have to go through them in order to get to the kingdom of God. Think about it this way. If you cheapen the journey, it cheapens the gift. If it was easy, everybody would be doing it. That's stuck in my mind many, many years, decades later, because it's, again, a spiritual lesson. If it was easy, everybody would be doing it. It's not just about accepting Christ in your heart. It's not just about believing. It's about facing the challenges, about living this day as if there is no tomorrow. Third point, third principle. He talked about people versus things. People versus things. And he tells a story of taking his nephew and niece for a ride in his brand new car. He had that brand new car with a new car smell, and he takes his niece and his nephew. You remember the whole concept of the new car? I mean, when my wife and I had our Jeep and it was that new car for the first few thousand miles, we wouldn't eat in the car. Or if we did, it was like that had to be vacuumed out immediately after sundown. It would come up here and eat lunch along the way. You get to the point where you don't want anything to damage that car. It's a thing. But he tells the story of his niece's nephew in his new car and pouring soda on the back seat of the car. Now, again, you look at that from a particular standpoint and you go back and say, I'm upset about this. Here's my brand new car. And here's my niece and my nephew don't care a thing about this new car that I've got, and they pour their Coke or whatever it is, Pepsi, all over the back seat of the car, making a mess. When you come to a certain point in life, you realize there are certain things that, yes, are important. You don't want people doing that on purpose, obviously. But making a big deal about certain things, sometimes you take a look and you realize that things are things, and you're not going to take them with you. That was the point that he was trying to make. And the people that are involved in your life are more important than the things that you have. Notice over in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Notice beginning here in verse 16. 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 16. He says, "Therefore we do not lose heart. Even though our outward man is perishing, yet the inward man is being renewed day by day. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory." He's talking about the temporary versus the permanent, the eternal. Verse 18, "While we do not look at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen, for the things which are seen are temporary." Spilling soda in a car is temporary. Damage to a car is temporary. Damage to something physical is temporary. But the things which are not seen are eternal. Those things that are truly important. Christ put it another way, where he talked about where you lay up your treasure, there also your heart is. The things that are physical are going to burn up. They will be no more. 2 Peter 3 talks about the fact that these things are perishing. John talked about that as well in 1 John chapter 2. where he talked about the temporal things of the things that we see. And loving the world and the things that are temporary, they simply will not exist any longer. Randy Pausch's principle that he talked about here is the people are more important than the things. Notice over in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Just another scriptural reference with this particular principle. 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Verse 32, he says, If in the manner of men I have fought with beasts at Ephesus, what advantage is it to me? If the dead do not rise, let us eat, drink, and for tomorrow we die. You come to understand that the physical things of this life are just simply not important. Soda on the seat means nothing. When I took that car that we had, Ford Fusion, I dropped my wife off at work in Salt Lake City years ago, and I hit the ice and I ran headlong into a snowbank. I was only going about 20 miles an hour, but the way cars are cheaply made today, it was about $1,100 in damage. Now, at the time, I was upset. At the time, I was frustrated. At the time, I was irritated. It's a physical thing. You go back and say, why am I so upset about that? Why am I so upset about a physical thing? The important thing, that was nobody was hurt. I wasn't hurt. My wife wasn't hurt. Again, you go back to people versus things. What is more important? Principle number four. Principle number four, he titled it this way. Are you a Tigger or an Eeyore? Are you a Tigger or an Eeyore? And he added, Tiggers always have fun. Now, he's referencing, for those who don't know, Winnie the Pooh. The story of Winnie the Pooh. And those are two characters from Winnie the Pooh. If you remember the stories of Winnie the Pooh, Tigger is always this bouncing, bouncing, fun, fun, fun. You know, always having the springy tail and going around everywhere. The wonderful thing about Tigger's is Tigger's the only one. You know, blah, 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 blah. He goes on and on and on and on. Eeyore is the gray-colored donkey in the story who always seems to be walking around. It's sort of like a storm cloud over his head. Oh, my. Oh, bother. Oh, how's it going, Eeyore? I don't know. He's always just, life is just so difficult for Eeyore. Pausch's comment here, Randy Pausch's comment was, Tiggers always have fun. In all the times I've ever with my boys when I was reading books, when we read Winnie the Pooh, I've never come across a Winnie the Pooh tale, a story, where Eeyore was ever having fun. When they're all floating down the stream, this one particular story, I can't remember what it was, they're all having fun and splashing around and Eeyore's like, oh boy, how am I going to get to the shore? I don't, you know, he just couldn't have fun. There are people that are like that. They wake up every morning and you wonder if they already still have one foot in the grave and they're just waiting for that other foot to be put in. Turn to me over to Philippians chapter 4. Philippians chapter 4. When you live like today is your last day, you need to live like a Tigger. You need to have fun. Yes, there's responsibilities. Yes, there are things that we have to deal with. Yes, there are troubles that we have to face. Yes, we will be persecuted for what we believe. Yes, there will be family and friends that don't understand why we do what we do. But you come back to understand that we can either choose to face it as a Tigger or an Eeyore. We can have fun at life, or we can just complain about it all day long. Notice Philippians chapter 4, verse 12, the Apostle Paul speaking here. He says, I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. If that be true, then no one should have to live their life as an Eeyore. You know, as I read Philippians, as I read Philippians 4 here in the statement that we just read in verses 12 and 13, I'm reminded that Paul wrote this while he was in prison. He didn't write it while he was sitting on a couch in a Lazy Boy recliner with a cold drink in one hand and a sandwich in the other. He wrote what he wrote while he was in prison. He treated whatever condition he was in as a Tigger. He could have treated it as an Eeyore. He was in prison, but he chose not to. He showed us an example. Notice over in 2 Corinthians chapter 8. 2 Corinthians chapter 8. 2 Corinthians chapter 8. There's a statement that's made here. There were people in the churches of God that, to a person, were probably Tiggers. Notice here 2 Corinthians chapter 8, beginning in verse 1. He says, "Moreover, brethren, we make known to you the grace of God bestowed on the churches of Macedonia, that in a great trial of affliction, the abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded in the riches of their liberality." If you go back in history, you'll find that the churches in Macedonia, Philippi, Thessalonica, and Berea were poor. But even in spite of that, the joy they had with what they were able to do with those that were even more impoverished. In other words, they didn't look at what they didn't have. They looked at the fact that whatever they had, they were willing to share with others. They had fun. There was joy in their life. They were Tiggers. They could have been Eeyores based upon their circumstances, but they didn't. They didn't. They did what they did with joy. Principle number five. Principle number five. He says, work and play well with others. Work and play well with others. Under that point, he gives three sub-points under this point of work well and play with others. He said, number one, he said, tell the truth. That's biblical. Tell the truth. Number two, apologize properly. In other words, I'm sorry, it was my fault, how do I make it right? Sometimes people apologize by saying, I'm sorry that you were offended by what I did. That's not an apology, right? That's simply a situation where someone making a statement that it's your fault, and I'm sorry that you got offended. I'm sorry that you're thin-skinned. I'm sorry that you have a problem. I'm not the problem. You're the problem. He says again, apologize properly. I'm sorry, it was my fault. How do I make it right? And then thirdly, under this point, he says, wait and people will show you their good side. You don't make them do it in a hurry. Show patience. It's the same principle that God uses with us. He doesn't necessarily expect perfection immediately, thankfully. And he shows mercy as he deals with us. If you go back to the history of the New Testament church and the writings that we have, even just in the book of Acts, you realize that the early New Testament church had its problems, but it was a church in many respects that worked side by side. They did good things in proclaiming the gospel message. Paul, in his letter to the church at Thessalonica, was encouraging them as he reminded them of the time of Christ's coming in chapter 5. Let's go back there for a moment. First Thessalonians. Notice chapter 5. Here in chapter 5, he makes, again, a number of statements that are just sort of, again, the way it's broken down for us as they interpreted the Greek text was just sort of sound bites, one sentence translations. But going up here in verse 11, he makes a statement here. First Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 11. Maybe some water would help. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 11. He says, therefore, comfort each other and edify one another, just as you also are doing. So even Paul, in his correction to them, or his statement, he says, you're doing a good job about doing this edification of one another. Continue to do it. Think about it this particular way. We are all soldiers in the army that is Jesus Christ, the leader. We fight a common battle, and we fight a common enemy. Now, the skirmishes that we may have individually may be different. But the ultimate battle and the ultimate enemy is the same. Therefore, we don't fight fellow soldiers, we fight the fellow enemy. Too often people have a tendency to fight the fellow soldiers rather than fighting the fellow enemy, the fellow enemy being Satan. Comfort one another, edify one another as you are doing. Notice over in Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 16. Again, talking about unity in this chapter and the oneness that comes with everyone working together with one common goal and one common understanding, one calling, one spirit, one baptism, one truth, one faith. Notice verse 16. He says, from whom the whole body, joined and knit together by what every joint supplies, according to the effective working, by which every part does its share, causes growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love. Every joint of the body works and plays together. Why? So that it supplies the needs of the body. You go back to what the Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians when he talked about the spiritual gifts, that some people were making a big deal about the gifts that they had in Corinth. And my gift is more important than your gift. It's not the way it works. The gifts are all important because they all work together, fit together in a framework where the body works and plays together, so that the body may grow. It's not so that someone has a gift that may be seen of people and go, oh, praise and wonder to this person with all the wonderful gift that he has. Some people want that. That's the problem that exists. It's the pride and arrogance. The understanding and realization is everyone gives a gift to the body. We'll talk about that in the weeks ahead as we come into Pentecost. Number six, principle number six. Principle number six, show gratitude, a simple and powerful thing. Show gratitude, a simple and powerful thing. Now, this is where I'm going to take you through the lightning round, as they say in a game show, you know, the lightning round. I'm not going to have you turn to these scriptures, but I am going to quote them. You can jot them down. Romans chapter 1 and verse 8. Romans 1 and verse 8, which says, first I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all, that your faith is spoken of throughout the whole world. Notice how Paul starts that. I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all. Gratitude. Ephesians 5 and verse 20. Ephesians 5 and verse 20. Giving thanks always. Giving thanks always. For all things to God the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. Hebrews 13 and verse 15. Hebrews 13 and verse 15. Therefore, by Him let us continually offer the sacrifice of praise to God that is the fruit of our lips, giving thanks to His name. Psalm 18 and verse 49. Therefore, I will give thanks to you, O Lord, among the Gentiles, and sing praises to your name. Psalm 30 and verse 4. Sing praise to the Lord, you saints of His, and give thanks at the remembrance of His holy name. Verse 12 of that same chapter, chapter 30. To the end that my glory may sing praise to you and not be silent. O Lord my God, I will give thanks to you forever. Gratitude. It's one of the most powerful things that we can offer to God. It's one of the most powerful things that we can offer to each other. Gratitude. Again, as I said, a simple and powerful thing. Number seven. Principle number seven. He said, complaining and whining don't solve anything. As a pastor, I'd like to have this engraved on something that I can read every day. And when I get off the phone or when I get done reading an email, I can look at that plaque and go, man, I wish I could just, maybe I need to have that in my email. When somebody complains, and just automatic, it's auto-send, auto-reply. Complaining and whining don't solve anything. Complaining and whining don't solve anything. His point was, just work harder. Just work harder. It's interesting that the famous baseball player Jackie Robinson, who broke the color barrier in the Major League Baseball, Jackie Robinson had it in his contract. It was written into his contract. Of course, you're going through a period of time where we're dealing with the situation that dealt in the United States with race. But he actually had it in his contract that he would not complain if people spit on him. That was written into his contract. Now, you know, you think about a lot of things. What if the children of Israel, what if God had had them write in the contract, you will not complain after you leave Egypt? They would have broken the contract, what, the first 24, 48 hours? You know, you go back and you realize that they complained and they whined. Did they ever solve anything with their whining and complaining? No. Again, as I showed you before, I believe Passover, when we went through that sermon, you realize that in many circumstances that they faced, they made the situation worse by their complaining. Complaining and whining don't solve anything. Let's look over here in Psalm chapter 3 for a moment. It's interesting. It's the words of David here in Psalm chapter 3. Now again, understand that there is constructive criticism from time to time when you're trying to work towards doing something better, but there's also the complaining and whining. That's different. And his point was, the complaining and the whining don't solve anything. You have to work harder. Psalm chapter 3, notice beginning here in verse 1, notice David. He says, Lord, how they have increased me who trouble me. Many are they who rise up against me. Many are they who say of me, there is no help for him in God. So here is David. He is, again, expressing a complaint, in a sense, before God. But notice what he does as we read on here. Let's continue on in verse 3. Because there's a transition that takes place. Verse 3. But you, O Lord, are a shield for me, my glory and the one who lifts up my head. I cried to the Lord with my voice, and he heard me from his holy hill. I lay down and slept. I awoke, for the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me all around. David expresses his complaint, but then he says, I'm going to go back to trusting in you. He didn't dwell in the whining. Let's notice over in Psalm chapter 13. Psalm chapter 13. Again, we go back. You see a positive response, but then again, you realize that David, as he's speaking here, it wasn't necessarily about complaining. He was then coming back to the point of acknowledging God, trusting in God, and relying in God. It's almost like you get a sense that he had to get it out of his system. A lot of times that I find through the years that I've been involved with people, that the complaining and whining, there's a person that says there's a problem, can we fix it? And then there's the problem that just wants to complain, the person that just wants to complain. That's generally a time when you're on the phone and you're playing solitaire at the same time because you know that all they do is complain. I'm joking. I don't do that while people call. You get my point. People are known sometimes to do nothing but complain. And there are times you have, there's a problem that we have. Here's a suggestion that I have that would fix it. I'm like, that's good. You go back to what we just read back in in Psalms with David. He talks about the fact that his enemies were encompassing him, and he went back to a trust in God. Therefore, I'm not afraid. There's a little bit of complaining, but he didn't go to the point of whining. Let's pick it up here, though, in Psalm chapter 13, beginning in verse 1. He says, "How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long shall I take counsel in my sorrow, having sorrow in my heart daily? How long will my enemy be exalted over me?" David, a man after God's own heart, was whining. He's whining. "Oh, woe is me. How have you forgotten me? How long will you hide your face from me? How long do I have to continue in this? How long am I going to have this heavy heart?" Notice verse 3. "Consider and hear me, O Lord my God. Enlighten my eyes, lest I sleep the sleep of death." In other words, help me to see and understand. How often is it when we go through a trial and that we go to the first two verses here, right? "Oh, woe is me, this trial that nobody's ever had to go through before. I am so alone." Front desk is going to come over here complaining, "What in the world's going on in the room?" We never really go, though, to verse 3. "Consider and hear me, O Lord my God, enlighten my eyes." In other words, show me the lesson from the trial that you want me to learn. Too often, what is the prayer? "Take it away from me, it hurts." Right? I know, because I've been there. David went to the point of saying, "Consider and hear me, and show me." Verse 4. "Lest my enemy say I have prevailed against him." Verse 5. "Lest those who trouble me rejoice when I move." Verse 5. "But I have trusted in your mercy." Again, you get back to the same thing. He states his case, but then he says, "I've trusted in you. I've trusted in your mercy. My heart shall rejoice in your salvation. I will sing to the Lord because he has dealt bountifully with me." David makes a statement. Basically, what Randy Pausch was saying, you have to work harder. In a spiritual sense, that means more prayer. It means more inner reflection on the condition and what we need to do to move from it. Randy Pausch concludes by talking about the seven principles. And in those 7 points, he talks about these are the things that you do to lead your life. His point was, and the point that I make for us this afternoon, is that when you live your life properly, good things will happen. Now, his statement is nothing more than, you reap what you sow. Think about that last point. If you're constantly sowing the seeds of complaining and whining, what do you think you're going to reap? When you live your life properly, good things will happen. When you sow good seed, when you live by godly principles, good things will happen. My best friend gave me the best advice. He said, "Each day is a gift and not a given right. Leave no stone unturned, leave your fears behind, and try to take the path less traveled by. That first step you take is the longest stride. If today was your last day and tomorrow was too late, could you say goodbye to yesterday?" Brethren, if today was your last day, what would you do? Randy Pausch lived his last 2 years with an understanding that his last day was in sight. King Hezekiah lived 15 years with an understanding that his last day was in sight. We are told that we have 70, or at the best, 80. Therefore, let us honor God by making the most of what we have been given.